Well, if you look at our table, it looks like we're preparing for something here. Something festive, something fun. We have our plates and our napkins and our silverware. We have serving dishes and glasses, even candle holders, and looks like the beginning of a centerpiece. I'm looking forward to what else will develop here. For those who like to have people over, part of the fun is the preparation. Setting a nice table is certainly a part of that, a fun table, if you will. I have a friend back in Kentucky, and she sets the most beautiful tables for special days at her house. That preparation gives her joy. She loves doing that as she anticipates the arrival of her guests. God is preparing the people in this text to return home. However, it doesn't really feel like a homeland. Generations have passed since the exile, and those who are returning have never set foot in Jerusalem. What they do have are the stories of the previous generations, stories of the grand temple and the descriptions of the great city, the nice homes and the gardens. So they were probably anticipating at least something positive, if foreign. Remember, God had told them while they were in Babylon to put down roots there, to plant gardens and build homes and raise families and become part of their communities. And generations have gone by, so by now they may have felt that Babylon was home to them. But if what they were expecting is what they had been told by their grandparents, they were sorely disappointed. For God had not set a beautiful table for them. And in fact, it was like nothing had been done, like they weren't even expected. The city was in great disrepair. The temple had been destroyed. There was devastation all around them. It would have been so easy to simply go back to what had become home rather than try to live in the midst of that rubble. God, however, is very quick to let them know there's a plan. And all along the plan was to release the captives and take care of the poor and oppressed and return the exiles to their home. So he set the table with promises, promises of comfort for those who mourn, the oil of gladness, the mantle of praise. He promises them the strength of oak trees. For it is God's plan that they will rebuild from these ancient ruins. With them, God will restore the city and the land. How do you prepare someone, though, for such an overwhelming task? There's part of me that would say, if I were there, Lord, I appreciate all you've done for me here, but the promises sound great. But this isn't what I imagined at all. I'm not sure I have the heart for this. I've already lost so much. But God prepares them by staying with them. These are not just visions of a future they alone will build. God will be working alongside them, strengthening them, sharing their future, reminding them God has made an everlasting covenant with them. And this is just the beginning, but it's a beginning that will lead to a time when they will be known among the nations and the nations will call them blessed. As we prepare for the coming of the Christ child, there has developed over the generations a perception of how we should be doing during this season and what we should be doing. And it has led to the holidays often being a very stressful time. We try to pack so much in to this month. For some, it's just too much activity, too much work. For others, it's the expectation that they need to be celebrating big, being with family or friends. There are those for whom it brings dread of toxic or dysfunctional family systems that make the holiday gatherings something to be dreaded. There are those who dread being alone, remembering Christmases past. You know, there are now books and articles and pamphlets about how to handle holiday stress. Doesn't that seem like kind of an oxymoron? Holiday stress. kind of like jumbo shrimp. And I often wonder what baby Jesus would have to say about all this, the stress and the negative emotion that have been laid on the celebration of his birth. But here we are today, singing about peace, even when there is no peace, and love, even as people raise the temperature of the judgmental and critical speech, and hope, even as we continue to have hungry and unhoused people, no matter how much we do. And in the midst of all that, some among us are grieving, struggling with issues of mental or physical health. Some people, their lives are a wreck. And we could look at the news on any given day and say, the world is a mess. We stand in the rubble of our own lives or in the devastation of war-torn countries or poverty-stricken neighborhoods, and we think, this must be how the exiles felt as they arrived in Jerusalem and started walking the streets of the city. And just as for them, God comes to us, this time as one of us, to bring good news to the poor, not just the impoverished, but the poor in spirit as well, to release us from the captivity of our lives and with the stress and the pain and the suffering, to bring us home, to lead us from mourning to comfort, to anoint us with the oil of gladness. Not because the world has suddenly become perfect or our lives are now all in order, but to walk alongside us, to be present with us, to assure us that above all else, we are not alone. God's promise is how he sets the table for us. The table's not yet ready for us to sit down and dig in, as you can note, but it holds the hope of what is to come. It promises a celebration. The people, while standing in the ruins of the temple, they respond to God's promise. And this had to take a lot of courage to say these words, I think. I will greatly rejoice in the Lord. My whole being shall exult in my God. Not because everything is fine and the world around them is in great shape, because it's not at all, but because God has come to them and their salvation is assured. They trust the promises of God, and thus they rejoice and are glad. And so, standing in the devastation, the ruins, the city that is falling down around them, they rejoice. Not in their circumstances, but they rejoice in the Lord. Now, those of you who know me that know that one of my strongest coping mechanisms is humor and laughter. And the same is true for my sons. When my father died, which was devastating to all of us 19 years ago, the boys and I found our comfort in laughter as we remembered the funny things that Grandpa would say or do. And believe me, he said a lot of things and did a lot of things that were funny. And some of them I don't think he thought were funny, but we did. And we loved it. And as we continue to miss him almost 19 years later, we continue to find joy in that laughter and those memories. And that's our comfort, is in that joy. Now, my mother and I, and those a few of you knew my mother, often found reasons to laugh at moments when things were hardest. We'd be in the grocery store and she'd be looking at different kinds of laundry soap. And I say, well, do you want your clothes to smell, you know, ocean fresh or citrus, you know? And she'd stand there like she was deciding the fate of the world. Well, let's see, you know? And people would walk by and think we were like little nuts. But that's what got us through when things were the hardest. As she faced heart bypass surgery, or when we were again in a doctor's office filling out paperwork, we'd find reasons to laugh. And after many years in ministry, I have found many moments of laughter. And sometime I'd be glad to share some of my favorite funeral, graveside, and wedding stories with you. I have a lot after 40 years. But each time, though, the laughter relieved that grief, relieved the stress of the moment. Some of you may remember Grady Nutt. Now, I'm aging myself here. He was on the show Hee Haw. And if you're too young to know about it, Google it. But he was also a Baptist minister, and he found ways to combine his gift of humor and ministry. And he once said, "Laughter is the hand of God on the shoulder of a troubled world." Hazel, I want to say that again for you because you live this. You live this. Laughter is the hand of God on the shoulder of a troubled world. I just love that. Having joy doesn't mean we're denying the pain and the trouble of the world. We're not turning away from that at all. Joy is our response to trusting in God, that God's hand on our shoulder will lead us and equip us for how we can be part of God's plan of restoration and redemption. That hand reminds us we are not alone, and that God is as committed as we are, and probably more so, that oppression is ceased, that justice occurs, that violence and hate are ended, that sorrow and grief are no more. And so we stand in the mess that is our world at any given point, and sometimes in the mess that's our own lives, and we can sing and rejoice. We can tell funny stories and laugh. For while we take the pain of the world very seriously, we do not have to take ourselves so seriously. Our joy is energizing. It equips us to do the work of healing the world by feeding the hungry, helping the poor, seeking peace and justice as Jesus calls us to do. Our joy is infectious because it can call others to trust and hope in those promises of God, and thus they can make their way to joy. The joy of this season is found in those promises of God where we can place our trust. We see the preparations God has made for us, and in the one God who God sent to be among us, as one of us, to share our common lot. He is among us and with us through it all, and continues to move us forward, and who welcomes us all to the table. No matter how or where we find ourselves, we too can sing and rejoice. Amen.